With his reconnaissance and cavalry problem solved, General Taylor was able to deploy his inferior number of troops into excellent arrangement, especially his heavy guns. And at Palo Alto on the 8th of May, 1846, and Resaca de la Palma on the following day, gained crushing victories, which sent the Mexicans fleeing in disarray back across the Rio Grande. Percifer Cobb, who was cited in dispatches for his personal bravery, gave most of the credit to his infamous Texans. Somerset, there can be no glory like the smoke of battle on a hard-won field. General Arista, seeking to cut our supply lines, brought his troops deep into the Nueces Strip, where in a two-day battle involving thousands, we taught him a lesson. I was commended for turning the enemy's right flank in a hot and dusty business. Rarely have I known a day of such blazing sun and such constant sweat. It was no parade exercise, and had not our artillery provided a stout performance, we might have lost. The Mexicans fought with a valor we had not expected, but what amazed me was the skill of my Texans, for I believe that they can, at full gallop, deliver a greater concentration of fire than any other troops in the world. An officer on our staff who knows cavalry history told me, "I would choose these men above Rupert's Cavaliers, or the best Cossacks, or the Turkish Mamelukes, or even the Moss Troopers who used to surge out of the bogs of Scotland to ravage the English towns." At the height of the battle yesterday, I understood what he meant, for I was riding with this boy Otto at my side, his white duster flying behind. And he was so skilled with his various arms that after we had routed the Mexican cavalry, I talked with him. His name is McNab, which means that he comes of good stock, which counts for something, I think. When we started our run at the enemy, he had two rifles, two pistols, two daggers, and two revolving pistols of a new make. He told me they were called Colts of the Texas design, made in Paterson, New Jersey. And he showed me how they came completely apart into three separate pieces: barrel, a revolving cylinder containing five bullets, and stock. This young fellow could fire 10 shots with his two Colts, while I fired one with my old-fashioned pistol. And he was so dexterous that he could reload without dismounting, and then fire 10 more times. When you have 20 such men at your elbow, you can turn any Mexican attack. Tonight, I am not displeased with my Texans, except that when you see 20 of them dashing ahead, each on his own, each wearing his own outrageous interpretation of a military uniform, you do wish that they'd had some proper training. Postscriptum. McNab, the little killer, just came to me with an astonishing request. He wants to quit the army temporarily. And for what reason, do you suppose? To get married. Yes, he told me shyly, that he had known his intended for some years, a fine German lass. "And has she accepted your proposal?" I asked. And he surprised me by saying, "I haven't spoken to her yet." I asked if it wasn't risky, riding so far to court a lady when the outcome was uncertain. And he astounded me by confessing, "I mean, we have never spoken." "Not one word?" I asked. And he said, "Not one." I asked, "Then how do you know she'll say yes?" And he replied, "I know." But he did not explain how he knew. Before he left camp, I asked if I could rely upon his returning to duty, and he said rather grimly, "I have several scores to settle with Mexico. I'll be back." Strange thing, Somerset. I already miss him, for I have found him to be a man I want at my side when the fighting begins. One afternoon, when the Ollerkamps returned from a visit to Fredericksburg, Emil said a surprising thing. "They told me that one of the rangers on leave from chasing Mexicans with General Taylor has taken a room at the Nimitz place." Mrs. Ollerkamp happened to be looking at Franziska when this was said, and she noticed that her daughter stiffened, hands pressed close against her dress. And when Ludwig asked, "What young man?" and Emil said, "His name is McNab," Mrs. Ollerkamp saw that Franziska blushed furiously, even though, to her mother's knowledge, she had never even spoken to the young man. The name McNab caused Ernst, the now-and-then ranger, to say, "What a wonderful fighter he is! Nothing scares him." Now Ludwig spotted his daughter's extremely flushed face and asked her sternly, "Franze, what's the matter?" Sitting very straight, her little body drawn tightly together as if facing an assault, her hands in her lap, Franziska said softly, "He has come to marry me." Her statement created an uproar. "You've never met the man. How do you know what he's here for? Who ever heard of such an idea?" But now the great force of character which had been building in this quiet young woman, product of her bravery during the ocean crossing, of her ceaseless work around the farm, of her unwavering love for a young man to whom she had never spoken, manifested itself, and she fended off her entire family. "He's come to marry me, and I shall marry him." This was a challenge which her father could not ignore. "Have you and he had some arrangement?" She blushed even more at the suggestion, set her jaw more firmly, and said, "No, how could we?" "Then it's true? You've never spoken to him?" "Never." "Then how can you say such a thing, that he's come to marry you?" "I know, and he knows." She was so resolute that her father gave up, but now her mother took over. "Isn't he Catholic?" "He is," Ernst interrupted, "but I think he did it only to get land." "He's Irish, isn't he?" Thekla asked. "Yes, but I don't think all Irish have to be Catholic." "I think they do," Mrs. Allerkamp said, and she looked fiercely at her wayward daughter. Ludwig was not satisfied. "You still say he's come here to marry you?" "Yes." "But how can you possibly know that?" Now Emil interrupted. "I heard that someone had taken papers on the land just west of ours." "Where did you hear that?" Ludwig snapped. This conversation was becoming too involved for his fatherly tastes. "Someone, I don't remember who, said that papers from the land office in Austin had been forwarded." "Do you think it could have been this McNab?" Emil broke in again. "He'd be a good man to have on our frontier against the Comanche. He knows how to handle them." Such talk disturbed Ernst and irritated Ludwig, who rose from the table, stalked out of the kitchen, saddled his horse, and rode into town, for he was not a man to delay unpleasant obligations. When he reached the wide and dusty main street of Fredericksburg, he reined in at the Nimitz place, where the family was building an extension to their small house in order to open a formal inn for the convenience of the travelers who would soon be coming this way. There, he asked, "Have you a lodger named McNab?" Without waiting for permission, Allerkamp strode to the door, pushed it open, and stood face to face with Otto McNab. "Are you McNab?" "The same." "You the one who rode with Ernst in the Nueces Strip?" "The same." "And you've been with General Taylor at the big battles?" "I have." With both men still standing, Ludwig asked, "Have you come to marry my daughter?" Otto had not intended that his proposal be broached in this abrupt manner. He had been in the vicinity 3 days, scouting his newly acquired land, satisfying himself that it abutted the Allerkamp acres, and learning to his relief that Franziska was not already married. With his courage increasing daily, he had decided that tomorrow he would let Ernst know he was in the vicinity, and perhaps in a day or so he could meet Franziska herself. Speaking to her parents could come the following week. But here stood her father, far ahead of schedule. "Will you sit down, sir?" "I will," Ludwig said fiercely. "Now, tell me, how did you get to know my daughter?" "I saw her, twice, when I came to fetch Ernst." "What kind of secrets did you have with her?" "None. We never spoke." "And just looking?" "Yes, just from looking, and from what Ernst told me." "Did he discuss his sister?" "Never. But he told me of your family, and I decided—" Otto could not continue. Either Mr. Allerkamp understood what impels a young man to sell his land and travel so far into a wilderness, or he did not. and if he had forgotten what tremendous pressures of emotion and longing and desire a mere glimpse of a beautiful girl could arouse, there was no sense in talking. Nor could Otto speak of the nights along the Ohio River when he first became aware of what a home was, nor of his intense sense of tragedy when Martin Ascott was killed during the murder of the Comanche, leaving pretty Betsy Bell a widow. Nor of the fact, to put it simply, that he was in love and had been for a long time. Abruptly, Ludwig asked, "Are you Catholic?" Firmly, Otto answered, "I had to be, for my father to get us land." "Are you a Catholic now?" "Who knows?" "Well, shouldn't all Irishmen be Catholic?" "I'm not Irish." Otterkamp was startled. "What are you?" "Scots. My father moved to Ireland years ago, then left." "You're a Scotchman?" "We call it Scotsman, and my mother was German." Otterkamp gasped, looked at the young man sitting opposite him, and asked in a low voice, "What did you just say?" "I said we call it Scotsman, not Scotchman." "I mean the next part." "Oh, my mother was German, from Baltimore."
"What was her name?"
"Berta." "I mean her last name." "I don't know. I never knew." This Otterkamp could not believe. To have had a German mother and to have forgotten her name, the name that entitled you to membership in the greatest of all races? "You forgot? You forgot your mother's German name?" "I never knew it." For a moment the two sat facing each other. Then Otterkamp rose with a cry of joy and embraced his newfound friend, his son-in-law-to-be. "You're German. How wonderful." Otto, who had never up to now considered his German ancestry an asset, was not allowed to remain indifferent, because Otterkamp grasped him by the shoulders, gave him a second embrace, and cried, "Come, we must tell her at once." He dragged Otto out of the boarding house, obviously intending to ride the 6 miles out to the farm. "It's almost dark," the young man protested. But Ludwig dismissed this sensible objection. "If she's waited this long for you, she deserves to know." When Otto said nothing, Otterkamp went on, "We found her 4 good husbands, 5 counting Quimper, but she'd have none of them." He said no more as they mounted their horses, then added, "We could never understand why she refused. She never mentioned your name until tonight, when Emil told us that you were at the Nimitz house." "What did she say?" Otto asked as they rode. "She said, 'He's come to marry me.' She must have known all along." The two men followed a rough road out of town, and as the stars appeared, always brighter as if to encourage them, each knew a great joy. Otterkamp, realizing that his child had come safe to harbor with a trustworthy German, McNab accepting the miracle that his strange courtship had come to such splendid fruition. At 8 the moon appeared, waning, but still strong enough to lighten the way, so that the happy travelers rode through the best of Texas in the best of conditions. In the tall branches of one tree, a brood of turkeys conversed briefly as they passed, as if they were gossiping about the strange events of this long day. And a coyote moved furtively along with them for a short distance, then cut sharply to the west in search of prey. They moved through gently rolling hills, with trees sparsely distributed marking the watered valleys. Live oak, post oak, ash, and hickory showed their rounded forms against the sky, with cedars standing darker in the background. "It's not like a proper German forest," Otterkamp said, "but it will do." "What's different?" Otto asked. And the surveyor, who had mastered all the nuances of his new land, explained, "There we had real trees, one after another, all joined together. Here each tree stands apart, jealous of its allotted space." After reflecting on this for some minutes, he snapped his fingers and said, "Maybe that's the difference, son. In Germany we were like the trees, all forced to live together wherever the Margrave said. In Texas, each of us stands stubbornly apart, each man on his own land. As they made their way toward the Pedernales, Alarcamp continued his reflections. Not a day passes, son, but that I think of Germany. The wine, the singing, the walks in the forest, the peasant food I knew so well, the good talk with Metzdorf at his shop. I long for those things so desperately my heart could break. He turned in his saddle to face Otto. You know what I don't long for? The tyranny, the false preaching of the churchmen, the horrible day when the Margrave told my son Theo he couldn't marry. The passionate remembrance of that day which had so altered his life brought tears to his eyes, and after a moment of silence, he offered Otto remarkable advice. When we get to our home, if suddenly I should cry out, McNab, you can't have her, you can't marry, kick my backside, grab her, and go where you will, but find freedom. He was trembling. He allowed his horse to move away from Otto's. Then, from the darkness that rose up between them, he said, Freedom is everything. Freedom is the salt of life that makes hard work palatable. Freedom is the only basis for a home and marriage and children. In some dim way, Otto had already discovered the truth of what Alarcamp was saying. He had sensed it when his father railed so bitterly against the ineptitude of Colonel Fannin. Damn it, son! If a group of men are fighting for their freedom, they ought to do certain things, instantly, without thinking. He had perceived it also when his detachment started marching head-on into the Mexican lines at San Jacinto. No sensible man would perform such an extraordinary act unless impelled by a lust for freedom, a determination to be free. And he glimpsed the universal truth of this when he saw the new Alarcamp farm along the Pedernales, for no family would have the courage to move so far from settled areas unless it longed for the freedom which space assured. There it is, Alarcamp said, as he pointed to the solid house he and his sons had built. And with a sharp goading of his horse, he rode into the yard before the entrance, shouting, Here he comes! Tell Franza that here he comes! When the men entered the warm kitchen, they found Thekla Alarcamp and her two sons sitting there. Franziska was not visible, for she had gone early to bed, and her absence caused Otto to feel a stab of disappointment. Ludwig, sensing this, shouted, Franza, out of bed! He's come to claim you! As Mrs. Alarcamp disappeared quietly into the smaller of the two bedrooms, Otto was left standing awkwardly in the middle of the room. 24 years old, blonde hair, blue eyes, short, less than 150 pounds, hands close to his sides and extremely nervous. He came, just as she said, Ludwig told his sons. And he was about to say more when Thekla reappeared, leading her sleepy-eyed daughter into the bright light of the kitchen. For a protracted moment, the two young people stood there, each looking with delight at the other. But the spell was broken when Ludwig shouted with joy that could not be misunderstood, And he's German! When questions were asked, with the two lovers still gazing at each other, Ludwig explained his marvelous news. He's not Irish at all, and he's not Catholic, not really. He's a good German. His mother was from Germany, from Baltimore. Mrs. Alarcamp and her sons breathed with relief at this extraordinary news. In order to find Franziska a long-overdue husband, they had been willing to have their unsullied German line diminished by the admission of a non-German man, even a Catholic. And to find that he was of their stock was a reassurance which they had not expected. The bloodlines would remain clean. The admission of lesser strains would be avoided. A good thing was being done, and a faulty one had not happened. Otto McNab was, to their satisfaction, German, and all was well with the world. "Kiss her, you dummy!" Ernst cried, pushing his fellow ranger forward. "You may kiss her," Ludwig shouted. And the first word Otto and Franziska shared was a kiss. After his resounding victories at Palo Alto and Resaca de la Palma, General Taylor could well have thundered across the Rio Grande and chased the demoralized Mexicans all the way to some logical stopping point, like San Luis Potosí, far to the south. But he was an extremely cautious man who could not visualize penetrating so far into enemy territory without his supply lines in good order. He dawdled away the months of May, June, July, and much of August before making a move against the northern Mexico fortress city of Monterrey. And when he finally did start, he had no clear idea of what route to follow. In his confusion, he called upon Captain Garner to take 16 of his rangers and a unit of dragoons to explore the long southern route via Linares, while regular army scouting parties surveyed the more direct but potentially dangerous route along the Rio Grande. Garner elected to take with him his usual companions, Panther Comex, who had proved himself a terror during the two big battles, and Otto McNabb, now back from Fredericksburg, whom Garner called "my artillery on the right." The rangers headed due south to explore the possibility of a route through the small town of San Fernando, and since it formed an important launch point for a dash westward to Linares, they anticipated a difficult fight. But when they approached San Fernando, with McNabb and Comex slipping ahead as scouts, they found the place undefended. So the dragoons placed their Negro cook at the head of the column, where, on a fiddle he had brought with him from Alabama, he played a screechy Yankee Doodle, while the surprised victors marched into the empty town. In their attack on the next little town, Granada, the rangers behaved differently, leaving the regular troops ashen-faced. The unimportant little town lay to the west toward Linares and was defended by a ragtag rear guard of the regular Mexican army. When these troops satisfied themselves that the Norteamericanos seriously outnumbered and outgunned them, they fired a few shots and withdrew. But a handful of village youths decided to protect their settlement. From atop the roofs of houses, they sniped at the invaders, and, by ill luck, killed a ranger named Corley, who rode with a good friend named Lucas. When Lucas saw his companion fall from this casual fire, he dashed into the village and began shooting at anyone or anything he saw. His fire was so intense that other rangers believed him to be in peril, so in they dashed, Comex and McNabb among them. And now the firing became so furious that houses were pocked with bullet holes. Soon Captain Garner and his men were in the heart of the village, where the killing became so general that a regular from Illinois listened in a state of shock. What in hell are they doing in there? He could not know that Otto McNabb had been at the massacre at Goliad, or that Panther Comex had one evening been forced at gunpoint to pick a bean from a clay pot, and then watch as his friends who picked black were shot, or that Ranger Lucas had just lost his best friend, or that Ranger Tumlinson had seen his father's ranch near the strip burned to nothing and his father slain by bandits who called themselves Mexican patriots. The Illinois man could not conceive of the general hatred with which most of the rangers viewed all Mexicans, nor appreciate why, now that sniper fire had endangered them, they wanted to punish the little town for every accumulated wrong they thought they had suffered. Substantial ones, like real murders and burnings. Imaginary ones, like whispered tales of Mexican barbarities. When Lieutenant Colonel Cobb read reports of the incident at Granada, he was so shaken by the brutal behavior of his Texans that he conducted personal interviews with all regulars who had information about the slaughter. And when he was satisfied that the evidence was accurate, he marched into General Taylor's tent and demanded that the rangers be dismissed from the army and sent home. "That I cannot do," Taylor said flatly. "They will destroy your army, sir." "How?" "By their senseless slaughter of Mexicans. They'll ignite the whole countryside against you." "That's a risk I must take. I need them as my eyes and ears." "You know that they take no prisoners. Santa Anna took none of them prisoner. Are we to descend to Santa Anna's level?" "Texans are different. They were their own nation. They have their own rules. But remind them that this time they aren't fighting Santa Anna." Respectfully, sir, I see only tragedy ahead. Send them home, now. General Taylor, always mindful of difficult tasks to come, refused. And a month later, even Cobb was quite satisfied to have the Texans on the scene. For when the army reached Monterey, everyone saw that the capture of this sizable city, with its numerous forts, gun emplacements, and interlocking alleyways that armed civilians could defend, was not going to be easy. East of the city, the ground was relatively flat, but it too was guarded by numerous forts, each with its own heavy artillery. And west of the city, on the important road to Saltillo, rose two small mountains, not unduly large, but high enough and protected by slopes that looked impossible to scale. The mountain on the south flank of the road was Federacion, topped by a substantial fort. The one to the north was Independencia, topped by a massive, stout-walled, dilapidated building called the Bishop's Palace. To capture Monterey, these two peaks must be taken. If they were left in Mexican hands, enemy artillery would make retention of the city impossible. The Texas Rangers, supported by a much larger cadre of the best regular army troops under General Worth, were assigned to take the two mountains, while Taylor took the city itself. And on the night of the 19th of September, amid a downpour, the Texans moved in a wide circle to the north, coming down to the Saltillo Road, where, on the next day, they captured that highway. Now all they had to do was climb two mountains in the face of heavy enemy fire and capture a fort on one of them, a stout-walled, defended palace on the other. On the 22nd of September, a rainy Monday morning, General Worth decided to make the attempt on Federacion and its fort. His men spent the first 6 hours gaining, with much difficulty, positions from which to launch the charge up the final slopes. And at noon, all was ready. "We go," Captain Garner called with no discernible emotion. Up the formidable steeps the Texans went, and whenever they were pinned down by enemy fire, the regular troops, just as brave, surged forward in their sector. But as the miserably hot afternoon unfolded, the wiry Texans had one advantage. They were accustomed to the oppressive heat and the rivers of sweat that poured down their faces. "Give 'em hell," Garner called quietly, and on his Rangers went. Incredibly, they gained the crest of the mountain and diverted so many defenders that the panting regulars soon took their sector, too. Without cheers or battle cries, the regular officer in charge simply pointed at the waiting fort, and like an army of remorseless ants attacking a parcel of food, they started across the top of the mountain and literally overwhelmed the fort, not by sheer numbers, but by the terrible firepower and irresistible force they represented. At 3 that hot, wet afternoon, Federacion and its fort were in their hands. But before the Texans could congratulate themselves, Garner pointed north across the chasm that separated them from Independencia and said, "Tomorrow we take that." Without adequate food, and with no tents or protection from the intermittent rains, the Rangers passed a short, fitful night, during which Lucas, who had led the slaughter at Granada, asked Otto McNabb, "Do you think we can climb that one? It looks steeper." "We'll see." "That stone building, much stouter than the fort." "We'll find out." "Were you afraid today? I mean, you're so much younger than me." When Otto made no reply, Lucas confessed, "I was scared real bad." "Only natural." "Tomorrow, can I fight alongside you? I never seen a man fire as fast as you can." "I always fight with Panther Comex." "I know, but can I sort of trail along?" "Nobody stopping you." At 3 in the morning, when the rains ceased, the Rangers launched their attack on Independencia. But now the rocky slopes were so steep and slick that it seemed absolutely impossible that they could be scaled. "Christ, this can't be done." But then came the quiet voice of Garner, that indomitable man who found handholds where none existed. "A little more." And up the struggling men went. This time they left the regular troops well behind, but close to the top their sector became so steep that each man had to fend for himself, and the regulars moved well ahead over their easier terrain. At this perilous point, with Mexican riflemen shooting down from the rim of their protected hilltop, Otto found himself with Lucas, who was on the verge of exhaustion. "Breathe deep," Otto said, and extending his right leg so that Lucas could grasp it, he pulled the near-fainting man up to the next level. There they rested, unable to catch any breath. But soon Otto pointed to a declivity in the rocks and said, "Looks easy," and he led Lucas up a steep incline and on to the crest of the hill. There, a wild fight was in progress, with the regular troops giving an exceptionally strong account of themselves and driving the enemy always backward toward the security of the bishop's palace. But now Garner, seeing an advantage while the Mexicans were engaged with the regular troops, gave a wild shout, no longer muted, and rallied his Texans, who with a mighty surge drove at the palace gates. The fighting was intense and terrifying, but with the horrendous firepower of their repeater Colts, the Texans simply shot the Mexican defenders out of their positions. "Otto," came a fierce cry from Panther Comex, and together the two men dashed at the gate, blasting a score of Mexicans and forcing their way into the interior. In doing so, they had moved far ahead of their companions, but their experience as rangers made them confident that others would soon crowd in to support them. Within minutes, Garner and 6 or 8 of his best men had joined them inside the walls. The killing was short and sharp, for the Mexicans had no response to the deadly fire of the Colts. How many died was not immediately determined. But when the fight was almost over, a brave Mexican who had holed himself into a position from which there was no escape fired resolutely at the Texans and put his last bullet through the guts of Ranger Lucas, who died in prolonged agony. McNabb, seeing him fall, wheeled about, spotted the trapped Mexican, and blasted him with his revolver. The Guardian Hills were taken, and the fall of Monterrey was assured. The pathway to Saltillo lay open, and the culminating battle of the North now became inevitable. For a Mexican adversary, much more powerful and competent than pusillanimous General Arista, was preparing an army at San Luis Potosí, an army so huge that it might well drive the Norteamericanos from the soil of Mexico forever. Although President Polk and General Taylor started this war, it was Benito Garza who started the fighting with his bold foray across the Rio Grande. But he did not participate in the disaster at Monterrey, where a fortified city, protected by superior numbers, failed to defend itself. As recognized leader of the irregular forces in the north, he had been summoned south, where he would participate in a bewildering series of events that would alter the progress of the war. In Havana, the exiled dictator Santa Anna, who faced immediate death if he returned to Mexico, had been having clandestine discussions with American officials, during which the invasion of Mexico was discussed in candid and sometimes shocking terms. The wily general pointed out that a bumbling old fool like Zachary Taylor was never going to march all the way to Mexico City. "Frankly," Santa Anna told his listeners, "he's incompetent." And he proceeded to analyze with remarkable insight the other weaknesses of the American position. Should you try to land at Veracruz and force your way onto the Central Plateau, all Mexico will rise against you and cut your supply lines. And no army can sustain an invasion over that distance without adequate supplies. When the American strategists argued that their troops could live off the land, Santa Anna replied, "Never. A million patriots will destroy them in the night." His arguments were so seductive that President Polk, hoping that a bold move would solve the strategic impasse, launched one of the most extraordinary diplomatic maneuvers in history. "What we must do," Polk told his advisers, "is test this Santa Anna to determine how reliable he will be, how far we can trust him, that is, then use him to our advantage." "Risky," an army man warned. "He's a sly fox." "We're just as sly," Polk assured him, a boast that each man would often remember in later years. New negotiators sailed to Havana, where they talked frankly with Santa Anna, receiving from him a brazen proposal. There's only one sure way to end this war. Have your fleet deposit me at Veracruz with $500,000 in gold. I will then act as your agent and terminate this unfortunate affair on terms favorable to you and acceptable to Mexico. But will Mexico accept you? When I set foot in Veracruz, I lost my leg in that city, you must remember. The people of Veracruz venerate me. I can handle this in a week. The American representatives were not fools, and before accepting such a proposal, they investigated it from all angles. But when they talked with silver-tongued Santa Anna, who knew English well enough to smother them with glibness at any difficult juncture, they convinced themselves that here was a noble patriot who wished only to end a disagreeable war on terms favorable to both sides. A remarkable agreement was drawn up, initialed by everyone. Santa Anna would be given a huge sum in gold, with more to come when the peace treaty was signed. A boat of British registry would be provided at the port of Havana, and Commodore David Connor, commanding the United States Caribbean Fleet, would be issued presidential orders directing him to assure Santa Anna's ship safe passage through the American blockade and into the port of Veracruz. If necessary, Commodore Connor could sink any Mexican vessels that tried to prevent the return of the hero to his native soil. At this point, Benito Garza received cryptic instructions forwarded secretly from Cuba. Report immediately to Veracruz and prepare a spectacular reception for a secret arrival. He was not pleased with these orders, but he was prepared to report where his country needed him. So Benito dropped other responsibilities, including his often interrupted honeymoon, rode south along back roads where Norteamericano patrols would not stumble upon him, reached Potosí, and hurried on to Veracruz, where secretly he organized a rabble for one of those demonstrations that flourished regularly in Mexico. He had not the slightest intimation of what was afoot, but he supposed that some general opposed to the present inept government of the country was going to make a pronouncement with a fresh new plan. 53rd since 1821, counting those which flourished for a single heady afternoon, for saving the country. On the reasonable grounds that anything would be better than what Mexico now had, he supposed that he would support the new grito. How astonished he was on the morning of the 16th of August, 1846, when the latest hero, prepared to save the country, arrived not from some inland barracks, but from the little British steamer Arab, delivered into the harbor by the American fleet itself. Even at that dramatic moment, Benito did not guess the identity of the savior, and then, to his great joy, he saw General Santa Anna, Benemérito de la Patria, come stumping down the gangplank on his best ceremonial leg. Garza needed no prodding to start his wild cheering, but to his dismay, hardly anyone watching this charade bothered to join him, and the resuscitated dictator marched into his domain in near silence. Seven or eight men, led by Garza, shouted, "Santa Anna! Santa Anna!" But older men and wiser asked quietly, "What can he be up to this time?" Soon all knew that Antonio López de Santa Anna was once again Mexico's El Supremo, with powers doubling any he had enjoyed before, and it was rumored that he himself would assume command of all armed forces, north or south. But whether he would fight, as some said, or sell out to the Norteamericanos, as others predicted, no one knew. When Benito and a score of trusted lieutenants met with Santa Anna that night, they asked bluntly, "Excellency, what are your plans?" And he replied, "Only one. Crush General Taylor at Saltillo. Drive General Scott back into the sea if he tries to land here in Veracruz." When the applause ended, Garza asked, "When do we march north?" And his hero replied, "When my nation calls me, and she will call." President Polk had, by this rash action, placed on Mexican soil the one leader who had a chance to defeat America's grandiose plans. And what was more astonishing, Polk had also provided the American dollars which could help Santa Anna turn the trick. When word reached General Taylor that Santa Anna had returned to Mexico as supreme dictator and was assembling a massive army to bring north, the old man faced a series of difficult decisions. It had become apparent to President Polk, a Democrat and a wily one, that General Taylor, a Whig and a blunt one, was receiving in the press a flood of adulation as reward for his victories at Palo Alto, Resaca, and Monterrey. With the shrewd insight which characterized Tennessee politicians like Andrew Jackson and Sam Houston, Polk foresaw that Taylor was going to use his military popularity to win the presidency in 1848, and this had to be forestalled because Polk considered that the general would be a hopeless president. Making a move that was both politically and militarily astute, Polk forbade Taylor to leave Monterrey lest he become trapped in the vast desert area separating Saltillo and San Luis Potosí. When Taylor's officers received the orders, they immediately spotted the error. "My God, this keeps us from chasing the defeated Mexicans into Saltillo and crushing them there." Percifer Cobb fired off a bitter letter to his brother. "The only good news I can report is that during this enforced idleness we have had the good sense to send all the Texans home. Yes, they're all gone, and I'm a free man at last, one who can sleep well at night. Did you know that at the height of our effort, one Texas company of foot soldiers demurred at fighting as infantry, saying that every decent Texan was entitled to his horse? Well, they took a vote. Yes, Somerset, on the eve of battle they took a vote whether to fight or not, and it was 318 to 224 in favor of quitting. So they just quit. Can you imagine Hannibal, as he faced the Alps, allowing his soldiers to take a vote as to whether they wished to scale those snowy heights? That clinched matters with General Taylor, who summoned me and said, 'I want no more of your Texans. Send them home.' I wanted to remind him that they were not my Texans, but instead I saluted and informed Captain Garner, 'Your Rangers are dismissed. Take them home.' And what do you suppose he did? Stared at me with those icy eyes and said, 'We voted last night to quit when our second 3-month enlistments were up. You're not sending us home, we're going home.' As we watched them ride off, one of my officers muttered, 'I pray that all decent Mexicans are safe in their beds, because, as I've told you, the Texans shoot at anything that moves and take no prisoners.'" When one Mexican general surrendered at Monterrey, he insisted upon an unusual paragraph in the papers of the agreement. "I must be accompanied from the city by a strong escort of regular army officers, lest I fall into the hands of your Texans." I led him forth, assisted by 11 well-armed officers, who had orders to shoot to kill if the Texans tried to attack. I was sorry, in a way, to lose Otto McNabb, not because I like him, for he is a steely-eyed killer, but because I wanted to understand how a man so young could have developed so forceful a character. Judging his entire performance with me, I found him an abler tactician than Captain Garner, and certainly a more controlled fighter than Panther Comex. But I simply could not understand his savagery. During the incident in Granada, I am told, it was he who reloaded his 4 pistols twice, meaning that he may have killed a great many Mexicans, none of them well armed. When I asked him about this, he said nothing. Rumor insists that General Taylor will ignore orders and march directly to Saltillo, daring Santa Anna to challenge him. I hope he does, but when I discussed the possibility with his assistants, they alarmed me by saying, "If he does, he'll need your Texans again. He despises them, but he knows he can't move without their scouting. My God, they may come back." Otto McNabb, mustered out at Monterrey on the 29th of September, 1846, rode with Garner and Panther to Laredo, then on to San Antonio, where the other two cut east to Sevier County. "Give them my best," Otto said in farewell. From San Antonio, he headed north toward the German settlement at Fredericksburg, and as he rode down the side of a hill, he saw in the distance the outlines of the rude wooden house that, in his absence, the Alarcamp men had erected for their sister. It was such a surprising object of civilization that those sentiments which had so deeply affected him when he saw the light gleaming from the cabin surged back, causing him to halt his horse while he gazed at this symbol of what was good in life. The powerful difference was that this was his home, his light in the wilderness, and he was so overcome by this powerful sensation of love and things civilized that he spurred his horse and raced down the rest of the hill, shouting at the top of his voice, "Francisca! Francisca!" And when at last he saw her come to the door, wiping her hands on her apron, he thought to himself, "This is what we fought for."